Until the last year or two, I had followed a policy not to speak out on the question of abortion, in public at least, out of a feeling that men had already spoken too much and legislated too much over the centuries. It seemed to me that abortion was an area of concern in which the women ought to have the major voice. It affects their bodies and their feelings and those very important and very basic instincts which are maternal. Yet somehow, if you look back over history, all of the rules and regulations and restrictions and philosophizings about abortion have been done by men who had the controls of their society. I have broken this silence in the last several years, not because I've changed my mind about where really the ultimate decision ought to come from and emerge from, but because the anti-abortion campaign has taken on aspects of a religious crusade. It has ceased to be a open-minded debate about a very important and very thorny public policy issue, and has become instead, at least on the part of the so-called right to life movement, a crusade which has become frenetic, closed-minded, convinced that its ideology and its position is the only one which has right and truth and God behind it. And as a rabbi, I know that whenever crusaders take to the road, many innocent people get hurt. When Christian Europe took up the sword to redeem the Church of the Holy Sepulchre from the infidel, from the Muslims, it was the Jewish communities in the Rhineland and wherever they happened to cross the route of the crusaders that were massacred and destroyed. And I'm afraid that many will be hurt and that great and unfortunate damage will be done to the body politic of the nation as this crusade reaches its crescendo and seeks to make its religious point. In 1973, in January of 1973, you'll recall that the United States Supreme Court ruled in the case of Roe versus Wade that the several states had no right to limit arbitrarily the ability or the availability of therapeutic abortion to a woman. This changed a policy which had largely been governed by states' rights, which was relatively restrictive, if not totally restrictive. It varied from state to state, and unleashed a great debate as to what were the permissible limits under which the right to an abortion ought to be granted, and were there, in fact, any such limits. At the same time that this important debate was undertaken, it became clear that religious winds were blowing, and they were not only Roman Catholic winds, which were not prepared to accept the new permissiveness, and which were insisting that there be a constitutional amendment to prohibit abortion, which were to return the conditions in America to what they were before January of 1973, if not to make them even more limiting. And when they were not able to quickly get their way, these forces began a campaign of political action. They are the classic single-issue group in these United States. They began by keeping a record of state legislators and Congress people as to how they voted on various programs which were submitted to them, having to do both with the restriction and limitation of abortions and or the funding of abortions. And when this was not sufficient to threaten or frighten votes to their behalf, they began to compile a hit list of Congress people who must be marked out for defeat, regardless of their positions on other issues, either because they were not willing to espouse the idea of calling a constitutional convention in order to create an anti-abortion amendment, or because they voted against the Hyde Amendment, the amendment to various funding bills which prohibited the use of federal funds in abortion-related matters. On this hit list in this election year were senators like Church and McGovern and Bayh, and these men were defeated. And they were not defeated only or even primarily because they were on this right-to-life enemies list. Many other issues were obviously involved in the campaign, but it couldn't have helped. And certainly many, particularly among the blue-collar workers in America, who would normally have voted for such men because of their strong pro-labor positions, were moved because of the frenzy which has been whipped up on the abortion issue to move their vote to a person whose economic positions were inimical to theirs or less amicable, and to move away from someone whom they were told stood in the way of licensed murder. The height of this frenzy so far was seen at the Republican National Convention, when, as you'll recall, a plank was introduced by the Right to Life forces and passed, which declared that all nominees for the federal judiciary should be vetted by the new administration to make sure that they were pro-family, which is one of those euphemisms which is used to say that they are among those who believe that the 77-2 decision of the 1973 Supreme Court must be overturned and that the Constitution must be interpreted so as, in fact, to prohibit abortion. Never before in American history has a major party insisted that there has to be some loyalty test imposed on all nominees to the federal bench to make sure that they will vote a certain way on a thorny constitutional issue. Now, it's unlikely that President-elect Reagan will follow this plank of the platform, certainly not scrupulously, though it must be said that he is on record as favoring a constitutional amendment which would prohibit abortion, except when there is a direct threat to the life of the mother. I do not have the feeling that Mr. Reagan is an ideologue in this issue at all. But certainly many of those who became his majority are. And there is no talking with these people. There is no reasoning with them. It is a matter of religious commitment. It is a matter in which God has spoken, and one must carry out the will of God. Now, what's the Jewish position on abortion? There is only one reference in Torah to the whole issue. It has to do with what we would have to call accidental abortion or miscarriage. The Torah tells us that if someone strikes a pregnant woman in such a way as to cause a miscarriage, he must pay a heavy fine. And if there is hurt beyond hurt to the fetus, that is, if the woman is hurt, or even if she, and if she, particularly if she is killed, there's the possibility this must be treated as a capital offense. Now, this law is not unique to the Hebrews. It's word for word the laws that appears in the Code of Hammurabi. It was a conventional law of the ancient Middle East. In those years, surgery was suicidal, and they could only think of abortion in terms of some kind of accidental or deliberate injury to the mother. It wasn't until Greco-Roman times that the possibilities of surgery, particularly during the days immediately before delivery, when the embryo was fairly well formed, became possible. In the Greco-Roman world, there were both chemical and surgical ways of dealing with abortion at that stage, final trimester and at the end of that trimester. And so you find, interestingly, in the Mishnah, in the first great code of post-biblical Jewish law, a law which says, if a woman is in labor and it is feared that she may die, one may sever the fetus from her womb and extract it member by member, because her life takes precedence. It's an interesting and rather subtle distinction which is involved here. And that is when there is a choice to be made between the possible life of the fetus and the life of the mother, the life of the mother must be protected. Now, in this case, Jewish law is distinct from the law of the countries which surrounded it and the cultures which surrounded it. The Christian tradition, facing the same levels of surgical innocence and sophistication, took a different position. The Christian position was essentially that we'll leave it in the hands of God. There's no way of knowing which life is the more important one. Therefore, we'll let nature take its course. God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And you have a church father like Tertullian saying straightly, prevention of birth is an act of murder. Nor does it matter whether one takes a life already formed or in the process of being formed. The Jewish tradition was that a life which is independent, which can master its destiny and take care of itself, is more of a life than one which has not yet proven its ability to stand independently and be responsible for itself. Now, from that rather interesting beginning, it should have been possible for the Jewish tradition to develop some rather subtle and indeed elegant distinctions which had allowed for various kinds of abortive procedures when, for instance, the life of the mother is endangered in an emotional sense, or when there is some knowledge, as we now possess the ability to determine, that the child will be malformed or disfigured in some major way. But in point of fact, most of the Jewish tradition remained within the very narrow context of this original Mishnaic law. There are a few rabbis over the ages who will allow an abortion at the end of the, just before delivery, if there is danger that the woman may go into insanity or may have some convulsive and traumatic emotional experience. But Jewish law does not permit and has never permitted abortion because of some knowledge that the fetus, the infant, may be malformed or disfigured. It does not permit abortion if simply because the child is unwanted. It does not permit abortion if there is a statistical danger, possibility, that the child may contract some disease which the mother is carrying. Generally, the halachists have interpreted this tradition very narrowly, though the beginnings were there for a much broader and much more flexible position. In Israel today, abortion is illegal. Israel continued the laws of the Mandate period, which were British laws. The Anglican Church is almost as strict in this area as is the Roman Catholic tradition. But in 1952, the Attorney General ruled that no one ought to be brought before the courts on an abortion-related issue unless there's a loss of life to the mother. And so, in point of fact, any number of hospitals and clinics in Israel do perform abortions. And a recent study of women in Israel discovered that one-third of all the married women who had been married for 25 years or more had had an abortion at some time during their marriage. And this brings me to what I believe to be the critical truth about the whole abortion issue. And it is that whatever we feel about abortion, it will not go away. Even when abortion is illegal, abortions take place. It's estimated that in the 10 years, in those years before 1973, before the Supreme Court decision, something on the order of 400,000 to 600,000 abortions, illegal abortions, took place in these United States every year. About half the number that took place once abortion became legal. We are in a position, I'm afraid, that if the abortion amendment or some other means is discovered by the anti-abortion forces to restrict abortions very narrowly or completely, where we'll simply do what the 18th Amendment to the Constitution did, and that is drive a whole group of people underground. The broken and bloody hanger is still an effective symbol in terms of this debate. That is, if we make abortion illegal, we turn abortion over to the surgical butchers. We open the person who has an abortion to blackmail. We make it something which is often carried through in rather unhygienic and unsanitary surroundings, without the proper kind of not only medical but psychological and social work support as it receives today. You can be guaranteed that there will continue to be hundreds of thousands of abortions in these United States, whatever be the law of the land. The only question is, do we force it to go underground, force a new criminal class to emerge, force many who are not criminals to engage in what would be described and labeled as criminal activity? Now, the anti-abortion forces know no bounds. Over 40 abortion clinics have been torched since in the last 3 or 4 years, and almost none of those who walked into these clinics and spread the gasoline around and lit the flames, lit the gasoline, have been caught and prosecuted. The police force in most of our major cities is largely Roman Catholic and opposed on the surface to abortion. These men are doing the will of God. It's only, what, 2.5 years ago now that a man walked into a clinic on Chester Avenue just a block from the temple, and from the main temple, and poured kerosene on the floor and lit the kerosene and walked out. He didn't even run away. And he was seen, and many in their clinic said they could identify him, but somehow he was never discovered and apprehended and charged. And they have, over the last years, not only compiled the hit list, but they have been successful in state legislatures and in the federal legislature to add any number of riders to appropriation bills, any number of limitations to federal activity, to all designed to limit the availability of abortions. Thus, no foreign aid monies may be used for these purposes. Thus, no one who engages in legal aid work with the poor may counsel the poor or give them legal advice in an abortion-related issue. Thus, a member of the Peace Corps, a member or a of the defense establishment may not use the medical facilities available to government employees for these kinds of purposes. Thus, the Hyde Amendment, that the government may not spend federal monies in order to provide abortions for poor women. It's estimated there were 300,000 welfare case abortions funded federally in the last several years. In the fall of this year, by a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court said that the Congress had the right to declare that there would be no more funding for these kinds of activity. And so the anti-abortion people have managed by their activity to create a situation where there is a two-class morality in the United States. That is, those who can afford an abortion can get an abortion, and those who cannot afford the abortion do not have the funds in order to avail themselves of this activity, this need. And I think we all ought to clear our minds of one stereotype, and that is that over 40% of the women who come to the clinics for an abortion are women who are married, who are mothers, and who have two or more children, and who simply cannot emotionally or financially bear the cost of having another child. These are not women who have been giddy or silly. They're not young 16-year-olds who've been out on a high school date. These are married women. The child is their husband's. The husband and the wife have together decided that they have all the children they can manage. They cannot, for one reason or another, given the family situation, accept another child in the home and do right by the child, and therefore they seek an abortion. Now, I said earlier that we also have another stereotype, and that is that this is simply a Roman Catholic-related issue. The Church, particularly under this new pope, takes a very dogmatic and narrow stand. Abortion is not accepted under any conditions. Abortion is murder. In the moment of conception, to interfere with the growth of the embryo is feticide and is murder. One thing that's often forgotten is that it wasn't until, well, just over 100 years ago, in 1869, that the Roman Catholic Church finally took this absolutist position. Until that time, there was a great debate in the church, largely based on Aristotle, who had argued way back in Greek times that what he called animation, which is the term he used for the time in which the soul enters the embryo, the time in which the embryo becomes a distinctive living thing, occurs at 40 days after conception. And there are any number of church fathers who have argued that ensoulment, that is, the right of an embryo to receive the sacraments, particularly the last rites, does not occur until after 40 days. But the church in the 19th century was very much like the Orthodox tradition among Jews in the 20th century. It was felt itself besieged, it turned in on itself, it narrowed its flexibility, and by a papal decision, a papal bull of 1869, the church declared that from conception, any interference with the development of the child in the womb of the mother is to be considered as murder, and that remains its position. But the right to life movement in the United States includes many others besides Roman Catholics. It includes many people from the Anglican tradition, which is equally high church, the Lutheran position. It includes many Orthodox Jews. The anti-abortion legislation, which was enacted in Akron, Ohio, about 3 years ago, a municipal bill, which was then taken as a model for many, in many municipalities around the country, was conceived by and promoted by a young Orthodox Jew in Akron, who, with a Yiddish cup, said, "Why are you fighting, you know, so directly against the whole issue? Let's rather accept the idea that abortions are available, and let's simply make it impossible through procedural means for abortions ever to take place." And so Akron passed a municipal ordinance which called for almost daily medical reviews of the clinical facilities, which called for all kinds of interventions by social workers and psychologists and educators and ministers, which required the signing of affidavits by a husband, by the putative father, by the parent, for a minor, that this surgery was permitted, which required so many steps in the process before the actual operation could take place that, in fact, through due process, the operation became almost unavailable. So we're dealing with a broad social movement which has now increasingly allied itself with a broad political movement, that of the far right in the United States. And what we see here, I think, and the reason that there is so little reasonableness on the anti-abortion side, is that what is being struggled for is not only the will of God, the ability to carry out the will of God, to be true to one's church, but we are seeing an attempt to maintain the integrity of an older, more family-centered, more, in quotation marks, moral way of life than one which these people feel exists now in America. The anti-feminist movement feeds into the anti-abortion campaign. The concerns with the rising rate of divorce, with the swinging population, concerns with the promiscuity and the ease with which sexual birth control devices are available, all these fit in one way or another into this community of the Crusaders, who are eager somehow or other to, I found this phrase in a speech that the chairwoman of the Right to White movement uses constantly in the United States, to reimpose Judeo-Christian ethics on the United States. The sense of imposition, which we found in the moral majority, which we find again here, that we have to take America by the shoulders and force Americans to live up to traditional values. This is very much at the base of the right to life movement. Now, I don't look upon abortion as a positive good. I look upon abortion much as I look upon oil spills. We need energy. Occasionally there's an accident, and then the countries involved must, as quickly as they can, clean the waters, purify them again, so that there's not a great deal of ecological damage. Abortions are always unfortunate. The anti-abortionists make two points. Their first point, I believe, is in a sense valid. They argue that abortion is murder. And in a sense, it is. Any taking of something which is alive is, in a sense, murder. But we have learned, have we not, over the last years, that because of the skill of our medical profession, because of the technological miracles of our day, that we have to make increasingly sophisticated, elegant distinctions. That the old kind of crude definitions of life are no longer relevant or meaningful. Thus, for instance, it is no longer meaningful to say that because the heart continues to pump, because the lungs continue to bellow, a person is alive. We now have something called brain death. And we do, in fact, interfere. We allow doctors to pull the plug when somebody is brain dead, when there's no longer any electricity, any motion in the mind itself. Because a life which is a vegetable one is not a life at all. And we've had to make some rather interesting and sophisticated distinctions at the further reaches of life, that is towards death. And I think we have to begin to make some rather elegant distinctions when we deal with the conceptional period, the beginning of life itself. One group would argue that we ought to define life only in terms of an independent infant after delivery. Others would argue for at the end of the first trimester or the second trimester. It's clear, however, that whatever position we take, that we are moving away from the absolutist position that it's murder from any point after conception, and we're trying to find ways of looking at a very complex problem that will allow us to make distinctions when these distinctions are necessary. And it seems to me clear that in an already overcrowded world, into families whose economics are already stretched to the limit to provide for children who have some opportunity to grow into competency, to bring into the world a child, a thalidomide child, a child you know to be mongoloid, a child you know to be so hopelessly crippled, is to place that family under the kind of emotional and financial trauma which can destroy the well, as well as that being who will never be well. The second argument which the right-to-life people make is an argument which is their own form of the domino theory. They argue that if we allow murder to take place in the terms of abortion, it will not be long before the society moves from abortion to going through the old folks' homes and, you know, killing off anybody who is incontinent or senile or senescent. And that one of the protections of the society is our commitment to the sanctity of human life. And whenever I've watched a right-to-life apologist make the usual slide presentation of their case, they almost always end up with a slide or two showing corpses piled up at Dachau and saying this is the consequence of a society which becomes indifferent and callous to human life. You must protect life at all costs. What they never say to you is this, that in the 1920s, Germany had perhaps the strictest anti-abortion legislation in all of Europe, and Sweden had perhaps the most flexible and open abortion legislation in all of Europe. That there's no necessary correlation between a society's position in the area of abortion and its callousness or insensitivity to human life. Indeed, one of the anomalies of the situation is that many of those who are aligning themselves most vociferously with the right-to-life movement are people who have consistently over the last years opposed aid to dependent children, public welfare, almost all of the humane social legislation which has allowed so many to escape from the poverty of the inner city and of our ghettos. Now, abortion is a complex issue. And in my humble view, abortion ought never to be looked upon as a means of birth control, of limiting the population of a society. I'm troubled when a woman makes a decision to abort a child simply for her convenience, because it will interfere with her career. But that's, in a sense, a decision that she has to make. I am troubled by it. But I think that the ultimate position that one must take is this. The issue of abortion is one on which people of moral sensitivity come down on both sides of the issue. And in a pluralistic society, once you say there is only one way of looking at this issue, and not several, you're assuming that you can coerce others who disagree with you on reasonable and sensitive and thoughtful, on a reasonable, sensitive and thoughtful basis. You can coerce them to accept an authority which you conceive and you impose. It didn't happen during Prohibition, and it will not happen if an anti-abortion amendment becomes the law of the land. Indeed, what will happen if an anti-abortion amendment becomes the law of the land is that tens of thousands of women, your daughters and granddaughters, will be forced to either go to Canada or to find a way to have an abortion done illegally. Those with the most resources will be able to find areas in which abortions can be done with a fair degree of safety. The poor will suffer the most. They will be butchered on the spot because no few physicians of worth will be willing to jeopardize their careers in order to engage in this kind of activity. And instead of adding to the sum total of human happiness, instead of having respect for life, having consecrated life, we will add to the sum total of human unhappiness. And some will lose their lives, and many will lose their youth and their strength. Those who are concerned with the family, those who are concerned with moral disciplines, those who are concerned with the sanctity of human life, ought rather, it seems to me, to be putting their efforts into seeing to it that there's an awareness of the possibilities of family life, that their own families are models of love and respect and honor and sensitivity, that appropriate forms of sex education are available in all the school systems through the land and in the homes of the land, that there's an awareness on the part of all that, in fact, the sacredness of human life is an issue which must be considered in all of its ramifications, and we must deal with it in religious school classes and discussions. It's a complex issue today. And they must begin to respect and to understand the nature of American democracy. That is, that we are a society where honest people can honestly disagree. And when you deal with something which is not a crime which harms someone outside the context of yourself or your family, we really have no right to allow the society to intrude, except to see that the medical and psychological and sociological social standards are maintained which are the best for everyone. Unfortunately, I am convinced, though I'm not a prophet, that an anti-abortion amendment will probably become the law of the land. These forces are strong. It's interesting that though every poll of American sentiment which has ever been taken has shown that a large majority of the American people favor the availability of abortion, the legality of abortions. It's interesting that once you get a frenzied, an ideologically committed group who can impose their will by sheer force of energy, by their determination upon the legislative process, when they face congressmen and legislators who must be reelected and who are very timid about opposing people who become frantic and fanatic on a particular issue, a minority can impose its will upon the majority with fair ease because the majority, us, are used to using reason, good sense, and to being open and thoughtful. We tend not to get organized, to go into cells and to create that kind of endless energy which writes the letters, which badgers the congressmen, which sees to it that day in and day out legislation is followed, which sees to it that vote records are kept, which makes it very clear that if they vote contrary to our wishes, we will vote against them, whatever else they stand for, at the next issue, at the next election. The anti-abortion crusade is in full cry. The right will need some victories in the next year or two. This is one which I suspect Congress people feel they can give to them without too much evil consequence. I think they're wrong. But I don't see that there's much that can prevent this from going that way. I would hope otherwise. We forget that prohibition was the law of the land for 10 years. It was clear within the first year that an underworld class was becoming rich and powerful, that gangsters were becoming essential to the straight society. They were creating a new standard of immorality, which had not existed before. But it took 10 years before the forces could coalesce, which brought down and repealed the 18th Amendment. It'll take a long time once an anti-abortion amendment becomes the law of the land to repeal it, and repeal it it will be. And many will be hurt, and much harm will be done, and very little good will be achieved, because the anti-abortion forces cannot prohibit abortion. They can only declare it to be illegal. Can we organize in such a way as to prevent their victory? Well, I don't know. We can try. But I remind you that our congressman from this district, Mr. Vanek, whose views coincide with many of ours on many other issues, moved these last 2 years to a pro-abortion position. And most of us, if we saw him, didn't bother to complain. We went along as if he was still, you know, on our side, because we see the whole range of a person's issues and concerns. And I suspect that if we take this as a prototype of what happens throughout the land, that's the way reasonable people operate. But what happens when reasonable people meet the unreasonable minority? That's an issue which America increasingly is going to have to confront, not only on this issue, but on many another. How does reason deal with unreason? How does reason deal with unreason when unreason is in full flower because of the frustrations that are abroad in the land? What I'm suggesting is that we have to unreasonably bestir ourselves from our professions and from our family concerns and try and be as effective as we can in the political arena in areas where there is potential harm and damage of major proportions to the body politic. The abortion decision is one which a husband and a wife, or a woman, must take with prayerful concern. Ultimately, I think the society must respect the decision once it is made. In this case, I stand outside of the mainstream of the halakhic development of the Jewish tradition. I could find other arguments within the Jewish tradition to buttress my position. But we face new possibilities. Surgery is safe. Population is no longer the problem. We face overpopulation, not the danger of underpopulation. It seems to me that we must accept abortion as one of the facts of life, which we unfortunately must accept as a possibility, use when it's necessary for us, but recognize that it is in the strengthening of the marriage, the family, in the use of the birth control devices which are available now to everyone, that the ultimate solution to a problem such as birth control really exists. Amen.